Welcome to a Prevent Connect podcast, where we explore the prevention of violence against women. This is a project of the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault.
Joan and David, I want to thank you both for taking the time to be a part of this podcast for the Ms. Foundation Ending Child Sexual Abuse Power and Prevention Web Conference Series. And I want to ask you both just to give us a quick summary of what was said in 2012 when we decided to do a web conference series on perpetration and prevention.
I think the basics that we covered back then were fairly simple in terms of the idea that what we knew then and what we know now is that not all people who sexually abuse are the same. And we can't look at that as sort of one monolith sex offender. That probably one of the biggest distinctions we tried to make is that, you know, there are adults who sexually abuse, but there are also adolescents and teens who sexually abuse, and there's also children who sexually abuse. And we don't want to treat a 5-year-old the same way as we do a 40-year-old. And I think that one of the ways that we can begin to get to that concept is that if you start thinking about not labeling the people, but use something which actually comes a lot from the victim advocacy community, which is using person-first language. So when we start labeling the behaviors, it becomes actually much easier for people to ask questions about what's going on, and then actually to ask questions and talk about what we're concerned about or confront specific behaviors. So it's very hard to think about how do I confront a sex offender. It's much easier to think about how do we talk to Joan about what she's doing and how she's acting and how the pieces that make me uncomfortable. So I think those are some of the things that we talked about in 2012. And as I said, a lot has changed, but maybe I'll turn it to David, see if you ever want to say a few more pieces about that as well, or maybe what has changed.
Yes, not all people who abuse are the same is exactly right. And it's not just a matter of age, but also it can be a matter of intention. And the newer research has really shown that, much to our surprise, many people who do abuse are very interested in preventing further abuse, whereas a small minority maybe are less interested so. And so we can make our prevention efforts more efficient by putting our resources into the right direction and help different people who have different intentions prevent further abuse.
I think that is actually quite interesting when we're thinking about primary prevention. When we are looking at a correlation between those that abuse and those that are harmed, and we think about the creation of prevention programming, in particular with regards to child sexual abuse, I'm wondering what are some of the things that you've seen shift since 2012 or carry over since 2012 to now?
So basically, I think one of the key things that I see is really shifting since 2012 is that we're beginning to look at, if we're starting to think about primary prevention, how to prevent sexual violence before anybody is harmed, people are beginning to recognize that we need to look at how to prevent the perpetration of sexual abuse. So one thing that I've sort of seen since 2012 is that the CDC, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, has begun to put out a lot of publications that are looking at how to stop the perpetration of sexual violence. And certainly the White House has begun to focus a tremendous amount of attention on preventing sexual violence on college campuses. And I think that's what I have seen just personally is like the people are beginning to see that when you talk about sexual abuse on college campuses, that people are beginning to start saying things like, this could be my son. And we're seeing that these are not monsters. These are people we know. And I think that and then begins to ask different questions about what would lead someone to cause harm. What are some of the risk factors? And what are some of the protective factors that would prevent someone from perpetration and from causing that harm in the first place? Even the fact that we're asking those questions now, I think, are some major shifts that have happened since our webinar.
There's also an increasing recognition that we can't simply punish away bad behavior in society. So one of the main reasons why we've seen declines in the past 20 years in the rates of sexual assault, sexual abuse, are that people are talking about it, that societies have been engaged in a dialogue about this, and that is one of the most effective ways that our communities can go about things. I think also my focus has historically been more on tertiary prevention. There's this recognition that our prisons are simply not returning our investment. We're locking up too many people for far too long, and that there's more effective and more efficient ways to prevent those who have caused harm from causing harm again in the future. And then finally, in my field of treating people who have abused, there's a far greater recognition these days of the importance of primary prevention, and that there's more people in my field who are seeking out new resources and trying to work into each working week some kind of activity that they can engage in that will help the efforts towards primary prevention.
And I think you bring up a really great point there, David, this idea that even if your work isn't directly in primary prevention, as you said, you work in tertiary prevention, this idea within treatment, incorporating aspects of primary prevention with the individuals that you're seeing. I have always sort of been a straddler. I've done direct practice, a lot of intervention work, and then also done a lot of primary prevention work or prevention across the spectrum of secondary and tertiary as well. And there was that blending of the two that I found very important when building out that I'm going to have an impact on either a micro, meso, or macro level. And I'm wondering, as we are thinking about these shifts and we're looking at better ways to do the work, I know that you both have talked about this idea of separating out children and teens that offend versus adults that sexually abuse. And I think that that would be really something interesting for the folks listening. Just wondering if you both could give us some sound bites on that.
Recent research has really highlighted just how many traumatic experiences there are in the background of children and adolescents who sexually abuse. In the past, it was common to think in terms of tough-on-crime measures like waving kids to adult courts, placing them on registries, and so on. And study after study after study has found that this doesn't work. And many of us have come to believe, until we've done something to resolve and address the harm, nobody can build a better future until they've found some way to come to terms with their past, and that's become an increasing focus in recent years.
I think one of the other things that have really changed is that I think that there used to be a really hard separation between those who work with offenders and those who work with victims. And I think that over the past few years, it's been exciting to, at one level, to hear the people talk about it as two sides of the same coin. And so realizing that we have very much the same goals here and the same values. But I think that it's even more integrated than that. I think that if we really want to think about prevention, we need to think about how do we have sort of early intervention? How do, when we see a child, whether or not they've been victimized, we see a child in a lot of high-risk situations, what can we do to intervene even earlier? And that moving out of what I see as sort of this toggle, like, is it abuse or not abuse? But that when you see something that's concerned, hopefully you've actually discovered it before there's any abuse. But when there's no abuse, it means that that's actually the ideal time for prevention. And what I think, I hope that by the kind of conversations that David and I have had in the past, that people will realize that we have an obligation to start looking at these behaviors and not be so afraid of it, because when we start seeing something that maybe is concerned, that really is the chance where, whether you work with victims, whether you work with offenders, whether you're just a concerned parent or a concerned person in the community, that's our chance to actually make a difference.
And I think that really speaks to the heart of what Ms. Foundation was hoping to accomplish when they partnered with Prevent Connect to create the Power and Prevention web conference series, this idea of, one, creating a community of practice in which those who are actively doing the work share information and gain information and improve the work that they're doing. But I also think that there's another component of, you don't have to be a practitioner to participate in these types of activities. You don't have to be a preventionist to participate in these types of activities. You can be a concerned community member that is looking around at your environment and saying, this environment is not safe for children, and then it's not safe for children, and then they cannot grow up into healthy and happy adults that can continue to make a better environment for the future. And so I appreciate you both coming in and giving us more words of wisdom when it comes to the connection between child sexual abuse prevention and work with those who sexually offend. And are there any last-minute comments that you have for the audience?
Just a quick reference to what Joan said, that we're also starting to learn about the factors that are going to prevent people from engaging in abuse in the future. And whereas in the past we looked at stopping bad behaviors, we're now also thinking about preventing behaviors and harmful behaviors by building on people's internal strengths and capacity.
Whenever I speak, I always feel like there's a little bit of silence, even though it's just the three of us talking. I can almost hear the silence of people listening to our podcast. And I think that silence sometimes comes from a sense of fear. And I guess my hope is that by having people learn how to talk about what is abusive, but also talk about what's healthy, and then talk about what's of concern. And I often talk about red light, yellow light, and green light behaviors. But if we can start mm-hmm. talking about what's healthy, then sure. it opens up the conversations at a much earlier stage. And to me, that gives us, gives me at least a sense of hope that we can actually change this and turn this around. And I want to use that as a plug to say that I think that Leona, you and Cordelia are going to be talking about that exact question, which I think is the place which is most hopeful. When we can start talking about what's healthy, that allows us to talk about what's concern. And that's a point of prevention and intervention. So I hope that we can excite people about the fact that everybody has a role to play here.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you both for sharing with us. We appreciate it as we add to our community of practice that we're building every time we participate in this web conference series or we create podcasts or even publish blogs. And this is Leona Smith-DiFaustino from Prevent Connect with Joan Tabachnik and David Prescott for the Ending Child Sexual Abuse Power and Prevention Ms. Foundation web conference series.
Thank you for listening to this Prevent Connect podcast. Prevent Connect is a project of the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault, with funding from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The views presented on Prevent Connect are not necessarily the views of the United States government, the CDC, or CalCASA. To learn more about Prevent Connect, visit www.preventconnect.org. For more information about CalCASA's mission, or to show your support, visit CalCASA.org. That's CalCASA.org.